Welcome to the Athenaeum Review, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Tomas Gaitkins, a renowned art historian, director of the Getty Research Institute and founding director of the German Center for Art History in Paris, former chair at the Collège de France, the Freie Universität in Berlin, fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study, the Getty, and recipient of many honorary degrees from the Courtauld, the Sorbonne, and numerous honors and awards. yes, and I'll make it short. The author of countless books and articles on 18th to 20th century French and German art history. Thank you so much for being with us today. I wanted to start by asking you, in the beginning of the history of the Museum Island in Berlin, about the Altes Museum by Schinkel in 1830, the aspect where the kind of religious aspect in which there's a rotunda which resembles the Pantheon in Rome and a sense of the sacred, the statuary. Could you explain a little about this sense of the religious or sacred aspect of art as it was understood at this time?
Well, you took it already very well. There's nothing to add to that.
Oh, okay. But I'm just quoting your Dr. Gaitkin's article, by the way. So that's his ideas, which I repeated. But maybe then the public or the rulers, they understood that. I mean, could this be a kind of substitute for the church, you know, the post-Enlightenment?
Well, let me say, no, I mean, you are completely right. There is this kind of, there is this element, you are completely right, because the temple front is, mm-hmm. of course, already an element to elevate you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So you go into a temple, and a temple, of course, is a sacred building.
Yeah.
You go up some steps,
yeah.
which also elevates you again.
Yeah.
And then you enter into the Pantheon.
Yeah.
So that is definitely something which, in a certain way, describes the experience of art as something which should bring us outside our daily work into another sphere. That is absolutely true. However, let's also not forget the building, the Schinkel Altes Museum was, of course, built first to collect all the collections, the major collections of the Prussian kings, which came back from Paris.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a very interesting story that there was the fact that it was taken away or stolen from the Napoleon period and brought to Paris.
Yeah.
It became more interesting.
Yeah.
And it became the understanding that, you know, the collections were there.
Yeah.
And they were in the different chateaus around Berlin.
Yeah.
But when it was, when all this material and all these wonderful objects were brought to Paris, they suddenly became and got another value.
Yeah.
And when they came back, there were not the collections of the king's private rooms anymore.
Yeah.
They became a national collection.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the idea from decoration of the castles was changed during this Napoleonic period. You know, Napoleon, in a certain way, he was very instrumental creating the different nations in Europe.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
the idea of nation building in the 19th century was created at this very moment. You know,
right.
And when all these objects came back, nobody was thinking to redistribute them into the different castles, then to gather them for the people. So the idea from the private castles and the private apartments of the kings to making them accessible to the general public, to everybody. That is the major idea. And why? And then I come back to your point. Why? Because art is necessary for everybody, and art has an educative element.
Yes.
So you have to see art to get to become a better person.
Yes.
And
yes.
That is that's why everybody should go to museums.
Yes.
To look at art to get you into a higher level of understanding your life and yourself.
Yeah.
So you discover yourself only if you are exposed to art
yeah.
and works, which then would, in a certain way, the transfer of the, there is the enchantment, but it's more than enchantment.
Yeah.
It's also a change of your character and your soul.
Yeah.
It's an educative process which takes place
yeah.
in yourself if you are confronted with art.
Yeah.
And that's the idea of Wilhelm von Humboldt,
yeah.
who was the head of the group of the committee
yeah.
To install the museum.
Yeah.
And that is why the architecture, in a certain way, as you say, is a religious or has a sacred element,
yeah.
because you go into the other.
Yeah.
And then we shouldn't forget the building is in front of the castle,
yes, yes.
which means the castle is in the castle is this is the castle of the king
yes.
who gives his collection to the people.
Yeah.
And he opens it. Then you know the stairs are great stairs over the whole, more or less the whole front of
yeah.
the building. Inviting everybody to step in
yeah.
to get this kind of feeling and elevation
yeah.
Which art can provide.
You know, in thinking about this aspect of the public, I thought that maybe in today, in our more democratic period, it might seem surprising that there is this importance of the people, but at the same time, this is still a royal kingly. It doesn't mean that the regime is a democratic republican regime. It's the king and the royal government believe that the people have an important place, but still as subjects of the king.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. It is not. One shouldn't interpret it in a way that this will change the social structure
yeah,
of a kingdom.
Yeah.
It is, but it is the idea coming out of the Enlightenment
yeah.
that art is part of a very of a culture which is provided by the king
yeah.
in an educational way.
Yeah, I think you had described also how this can also relate to the history of taste and so forth, in the sense that, for example, the Renaissance, as seen by Wilhelm Bode and Jakob Burckhardt, was important because of the idea of the individual, the free individual, and creative, the sense of the individual's powers. And this is how the collectors and so forth saw the Renaissance at this period.
I think we should distinguish between the time around 1800
yes, yes, yes. This is later.
And the later period.
Yeah.
Also in 1830 when the museum was opened.
Yeah.
The collections were mainly Italian art from the Renaissance until the Baroque period.
Right.
But I think the idea of Wilhelm von Bode, which then was realized in the Bode Museum
yeah.
or in the Kaiser Friedrich Museum, how it was called when it was opened, was a different idea. So
yeah.
We are in the period of Romanticism and Classicism
right.
and Romanticism in 1830,
yeah.
Which is in a certain way different from interpretation of the Renaissance
okay.
In around 1900, where
okay.
We have just another little atmosphere, and
yes.
we have also a different society which is collecting. So in a certain way, the museum in 1830 was a museum which brought together the collections of the kings and opened, if you want, the castle's collections to the general public as in an educational process, whereas around 1900 a bourgeoisie which existed at this time, which was with very successful entrepreneurs at the end of the 19th century, in this boom of the general social and economical development, identified with a period of the Italian Renaissance,
and
collected themselves to, in a certain way, move into this area and try to establish themselves as the new princes, like the Medici princes.
Right.
And these kind of collections then went into the Bode Museum with Bode's consulting. So this is a different social and political and also economical area compared to the time around 1830.
In your lecture, you showed photographs of a couple of examples of rooms in villas of these bourgeois collectors, and also discussed Bode's concept of the style room, which incorporates painting and sculpture and so forth. Could you describe how these Bode's idea of the style room developed and how he came to take that approach?
This is a very interesting question, which needs more research. But what I can say is that Bode had from the very beginning an idea to combine the different genres. So he was a specialist of Rembrandt paintings and of Italian sculptures of the 15th and 16th centuries and of other areas, the Middle Ages. But he was very much interested also in the history of the decorative art.
Yeah.
And he considered he was not only studying one direction of the arts, he was really interested in getting an idea of the whole period, and in all its different interpretations, and so he collected tapestries and fabrics and ceramics and all kinds of decorative arts he could get from this period. And the idea was to create an atmosphere of the moment in history, which he tried to get everything together so that you could have an idea of how a prince, a Medici prince, was living in Florence.
Yeah.
So to reconstruct, in a certain way, an interior of a rich merchant in the 16th century in Florence or Rome. And this was, of course, artificial because it was random what he could get.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
in a certain way, he tried to reconstruct that.
Yeah.
His collectors were, of course, the ideal people to try that out.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They were interested and they wanted to learn from him, and they wanted to create their atmosphere around them, which was an atmosphere of prestige.
Yes,
also,
yes,
what
yes,
they
yes.
wanted to demonstrate.
Yeah,
and there were models, if you ask for the models where it came from. I think it's not really an invention of Buddha, because you know you had these great collections by the Rothschilds in
Yes.
Paris, and then Spitzer, who was one of the Rothschild bankers, he had an absolutely fabulous collection,
Yeah.
and they were living with this. And you know, there is a very strong French collecting tradition behind Buddha's concept. Buddha
Yeah.
was quite often going to Paris. He was also going often to London, but he also knew the collections in Paris.
Yeah.
And so this kind of atmosphere he was trying
Yeah.
to get into the Berlin ambitious collections.
Yeah.
And he tried out how this would work and how that could be brought into a display in the
Yeah.
museum. And the Buddha Museum, or the Kaiser Friedrich Museum in 1904, tried in the display to do two things. First of all, he was absolutely aware that the major paintings, for example, should have their free room. So he was very careful. If you look at the walls, if you interpret these different walls,
Yeah.
we have photographs,
Yeah.
so we know exactly how it looked like.
Yeah.
He was very aware of not of preventing that a major Rembrandt or a major Raphael
Yeah.
had its space
Mm-hmm.
so that it could be contemplated
Yeah.
In without any destruction.
Yeah.
And then he also, he says himself, sometimes I have put some element of the decorative arts close to these paintings to bring the visitor to this space, to give it an accent in the
Yeah.
room.
Yeah.
So he was really, and then sometimes he had a fabric behind the statue
Yeah.
to give more relief
Yes,
to the
yes,
statue.
wow.
So what he was trying to do was to create the atmosphere of the time, and at the same time evaluating
Yeah.
the object itself
Yeah.
so that it comes out in his in his uniqueness, you
Yeah.
know, in his special character.
Yeah.
So what he really didn't want, and there were many people criticized that this is just a kind of flea market, you know,
Yeah.
atmosphere. That's exactly what he wanted to prevent.
Uh-huh.
So you, if you try to interpret that, you can find out that there is a strong element to distinguish between important works of art and lesser important
Yes.
works of art. So you can read the display
Yeah.
if you really look a little bit closer.
And I believe that you'd also mentioned as the museum field developed, there was some conflict between, I guess, the ethnological approach of collecting objects simply as representatives of a culture, as opposed to the connoisseurial approach of finding the best, greatest examples. And this played out in the museum.
Well, I mean, there is, he was looking to combine that
Yeah.
in a certain
okay.
way.
Okay.
You know, but look at our museums today.
Yeah.
You know, most of the museums are representations of the history of art at the wall.
Yeah.
You know? So it is the Vasarian concept. So, you know, you go from Botticelli to the late Vasari,
Yeah.
and you have representations on the wall. I mean, the public is not really prepared to really follow that, you know,
Yeah,
because
yeah.
they have no idea about the art historical background.
Right.
In a certain way, what we do is to put our Western art historical knowledge, we try to describe this art historical narrative
Yeah.
on the wall.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have the material to do that, sometimes you have gaps.
Yeah.
But basically, that's how painting galleries are displayed. Now, that's exactly what Bode didn't want to do. Bode wanted to create an atmosphere of the time,
yeah,
and represent the major works of art in their individuality at the same time. So it is a kind of combination.
Yeah,
it can be sometimes confusing.
Yeah,
and it can be sometimes also. Sometimes it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't today reconstruct Boulder.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is not possible.
Yeah.
And you don't want to do this because,
yeah,
you know, first of all, he had his material and we have now more and we have other ideas about the works of art he had. So
yeah,
we wouldn't do this.
Right.
But in a certain way, we might come in the next, decades or so to,
yeah,
find a compromise between these two,
yeah,
possibilities. You know, there is, you know, if you go to the to a great collection like the Metropolitan Museum or the Washington National Gallery, they have an abundance of, let's say, 16th and,
right,
century Renaissance art, and so, but you know, the complete separation of decorative arts and paintings,
right,
is artificial.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
It comes out of a certain tradition, how, mm-hmm, we teach art history, how we have developed knowledge in different periods. I think we might consider of bringing this a little bit better,
yeah,
together.
Yeah.
And also. Rooms with only decorative arts, it's nice to study the different forms and the specialists are happy,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
why not have some kind of a combination? I mean, more,
yeah,
and more I have the feeling that this is already on the way, and
yeah,
many galleries are trying to make these galleries more lively in,
yeah,
combining,
yeah,
these different drawings.
It's not only for the specialists, after all, who to,
yeah,
to see it.
No, absolutely. Museums are not only for art historians.
Yes, yes, yes. I wanted to ask you also, I was very interested that, again, with the history of taste in the late 19th century, that I guess the certain maybe political overtones for certain artists, for example, you mentioned Botta's study of Rembrandt, who I understand was a representative of the Dutch Republic and the kind of democratic values of freedom and so,
yeah,
forth. But then also this case of the conflict over impressionism and the taste for more conservative like academic battle scenes versus international French impressionism. Could you describe some of this kind of the conflict in different tastes and the different camps who are...
Well, this is a very big
subject. Yeah.
It's a very big topic. Anyway, I mean, at the same time when Bode was building his museum around 1900, you know, this society in Germany under Wilhelm II, but
yeah,
already before, was a very divided society. And on the one hand, you know, you have to know there was an academy in Berlin, which,
yeah,
was run by a director, Anton von Werner,
yeah,
who was a rather conservative artist coming out of the realist tradition in,
right,
Germany, following the classical tradition,
yeah,
of the hierarchy of genres, where the history painting is the most,
yeah,
important genre, and then come all the others, and he was a genre and history painter, and,
yeah,
painted the most important official events,
yeah,
of the royal court, like the proclamation of the empire in,
yeah,
1871 in Versailles. So,
yeah,
he did this very important historical painting. So, and this was the taste of the emperor.
Yeah,
and the emperor, especially William II, was very convinced that he had a very good taste.
Yeah.
So he was following this kind of tradition.
Yeah.
And you know, especially the Jewish successful entrepreneurs, they had other interests. And they also, as always, were international.
Yes.
And so they had contacts to France, they had contacts to England, they had contacts to Italy. So they, of course, were educated.
Yes.
They were interested in developing also the taste further. So this was the society, the director of the museum of the National Gallery could find help to acquire modern and contemporary art.
Yeah.
So very early, already in the 1890s, the director Hugo Fanciulli was going to Paris and was able to acquire Impressionist paintings.
Yeah.
At a time when even in France, contemporary paintings didn't go into the Musée du Luxembourg. Was it Lex Caillebotte then?
Yeah.
It started that Impressionist paintings were acquired by the state. But it was rather late, or more or less at the same time when the Germans already had bought these paintings. And there was even one family, the Bernsteins, they already bought Manet's in the 80s. And so in the 80s, you could also see a very, very important collection of Impressionist paintings in Berlin.
Wow.
You know, so that was rather early in the reception of modern and contemporary art. So you had, on the one hand, this trend of moving on to propagate modern and contemporary art, especially French art.
Yeah.
And then it went into the early 20th century with very important dealers like Cassira, who of course had a gallery in Berlin which was selling Renoir and Monet and Manet and whatever you can think of. And the major paintings, which are now at the Courtauld, were in Berlin for a moment.
Yeah.
They didn't find a buyer, but they were in Berlin, so they could have been bought. So people bought other paintings, but not these ones. But in a certain way, it was a very lively intellectual atmosphere. And parallel to that was Buddha. Buddha was favorable. Up to a point.
Yeah.
He respected Impressionism.
Yeah.
He was a friend of Liebermann,
mm-hmm.
and he had a very beautiful painting by Liebermann in his house.
Yeah.
And he didn't go as far as the Blaue Reiter, the Brücke, or the more modern artists, which revolted against the Impressionists in a certain way around 1910. Or so.
Right.
He didn't understand the Expressionists, and he didn't understand abstract painting.
Right.
That was not his world anymore.
Right.
But he was tolerant.
Yeah.
To the acquisitions of Impressionists. It's not that he was extremely helpful to Hugo von Trudy, because they were trying to convince the same people to help them, you know. So these collectors had, let's say, ancient furniture and Impressionist paintings.
Yeah.
And some had Renaissance paintings.
Yeah.
And also an Impressionist painting.
Yeah.
So, that's always, you know, if you do fundraising, you fish in the same area of people. So, so in a certain sense, they were also competing with these interesting, especially above all, a Jewish community.
Yeah.
Which I understood is very different from America, because the rich collectors around 1900 did not come from the Jewish background as in Europe. That was a complete different background. This is very interesting.
And maybe it was later at a later date. I wanted to ask you also about the conception of architecture, especially among the later. You already discussed the Altus Museum, but as the National Gallery, and then the Kaiser Friedrich Museum and the Pergamon Museum, there was some way in which these buildings reflected the royal history, but they were also more modern. Could you describe?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I'll tell you only if you give me a little bit more coffee.
Yes, please.
What I think about this. Thank you. This is very fascinating. We have the Altus Museum, which is a neoclassical building.
Yes.
And it is a temple architecture.
Yeah.
And then we have the Neues Museum, which is which is in between the Altus Museum and the National Gallery.
Right.
It is a very beautiful building, but it is not. It has no temple.
Yeah.
Front. And the National Gallery is, of course, another Acropolis building.
Yeah.
And was opened at a moment where the German Empire was just proclaimed.
Yes.
Proclaimed. And it was, in fact, the inscription says 71, but this is not true. It was alluding to the proclamation of the Prussian king as emperor in Versailles, but it was, in fact, opened only in 76. But it was, of course, a confrontation to France, Germans now finally, and it was a provocation to France.
Yeah.
So Germans now are united and are building one nation. And the Prussian king is the representative of this German nation, also in providing and helping to build a museum for all Germans. So this is also a political statement, which is very clear in the architecture. So the next building, the Kaiser Friedrich Museum, is a Baroque building.
Uh-huh.
And this is a Prussian building.
Yeah.
And the building is, the whole concept of the architecture by Ine is to remind the Potsdam chateaus.
Yes, yes.
So it is more or less Baroque, or let's say Rococo architecture, and not so much a classical architecture. So it alludes to the Prussian tradition and alludes to Frederick the Great.
Yeah.
Had this a great collection of French paintings, and then also bought Italian and Flemish paintings, and so that this is from the outside a more Baroque Prussian tradition, and then it is a history of architecture with a lot of meaning, because if you enter, you have a huge Baroque dome, and then in this dome you have the statue. Normally the statue outside, and there's another one outside, and there's another, and there's Frederick III outside, but inside you had the founder of the Prussian kingdom, and he is inside, and so this is of course a dedication to Prussia, and then you go inside, and then you are in a 15th century Renaissance church, which then, of course, relates to Bode's idea to have the altar pieces the collection had, and which he mostly acquired, could be seen in the respective architecture.
Yeah.
So he built the architecture for the collection.
Yeah.
So this Renaissance chapel is an artificial chapel. It is not a chapel, but it is to give the altars their charisma or their spirit, where they could be seen in the context in which they have been placed in the first place. So, and then you, if you go through, you come into the staircase, which guides you into the second floor. Yeah. And there you have a kind of cupola, which is a complete 18th century architecture. Yeah. And the design is taken from Knobelsdorf or the architects of Frederick the Great. And you have also the statue of Frederick the Great with his generals in the niches of the cupola. So this is an architecture parlante, if you want. Mm-hmm. It is a historicist architecture, which of course in a certain way relates to the earlier period. There is a whole idea that architecture represents the greatness and the tradition of supporting the arts by the Prussian kings. Yeah. And then the Pergamon Museum is a big break.
Yeah.
And of course, Messel goes back in a certain way to the tradition of Schinkel and the classical classical antiquity. But in a modern way, of course, Peter Behrens was before, you know, and so all modern and contemporary architecture goes into this again classical architecture.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a revival of classicism in a complete different time, and started, not to forget, still started under the Prussian king, because Wilhelm II was still out when they started to build the Pergamon Museum, which then only was finished in 1930.
Yes.
After a Buddhist death in 29.
This is the Athenaeum Review, and our guest today is Thomas Gaitkins, whose visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History. The Athenaeum Review is produced by Creative Disturbance and the UTD School of Arts and Humanities. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.